From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and sustainability. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Next week starts the Transat Shock Vabra Race, a 5,600-mile transatlantic sailing competition from Le Havre, France to Itajaí, Brazil.
Approximately 50 boats, including multi-hulled craft, will set sail from the French port on November 3rd, sail southwest across the eastern Atlantic, the equator, and the southern Atlantic, and then finish in the Brazilian coastal town somewhere around the first week of December.
That's right, and joining us in the first half of the show will be Rob Windsor and Hannah Jenner. They will be piloting the monohulled sloop, sponsored by 11th Hour Racing. We'll talk to them about the boat, the race, and some of the environmentally minded equipment and solutions they plan to bring with them.
And then, in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Kenner Kingston, a local architect, partner, and sustainability director in the firm of Architectural Nexus. He'll share with us an alternative to the LEED rating system for green building design, construction, and operation. It's called the Living Building Challenge, and it considers the seven petals of environmentally friendly and sustainable building. Kenner Kingston will explain in the second half of the show.
All that and some news on just how warm this past September was, just how bad the air was in Salt Lake City this past week, and just how thin our atmosphere really is.
Of course, you can join in on today's discussion by posting your questions or your comments to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, or emailing us at kpcwthisgreenearth@gmail.com.
The environment and our connections to it. That's This Green Earth. It all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Cindy with KPCW Radio. On Friday, November 8th, Summit County will come together with one purpose, to help fund our area nonprofit organizations. KPCW supports all area nonprofits. Did you know that KPCW provides nearly $500,000 annually in free public service announcements to the nonprofit community? Could we charge for this? Sure, but we're KPCW. Please consider donating to KPCW to fund our open door policy on November 8th. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond with Republic Services, your recycling and garbage services provider and a proud supporter of KPCW. Recycling pickup in Summit County is now every other week. Remember, recycling materials go in your larger blue or brown bin. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
This is Ann from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch. We're proud to have helped KPCW grow and flourish since 1983. Park City Nursery and the Tree Ranch have a variety of products to help your yard and garden do the same. Flowers, seeds, shrubs, and trees, water-wise sprinklers, consulting, and landscaping. We know what grows at ParkCityNursery.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson. And joining us by phone from France, where they are planning to set sail next week in the Transat Jacques Vabre. And if I got that wrong, let me know, guys. Transat Jacques Vabre race, which will start in Le Havre, France, and end in, I'll probably mangle this too, the Itajaí, Brazil, is sailors Rob Windsor and Hannah Jenner. And they're here to talk about the race, their boat, and some of their environmentally friendly or conscious equipment and processes they're going to be using while they're racing. Thanks for joining Nell and myself on This Green Earth this morning.
Well, thank you for having us. Pleasure.
Great. We can hear you well. First of all, how did you guys weather the storm yesterday?
The red village got lines up and all the flowers and tied down well. So it was wild. The red village survived, and now it's all back open and people again.
Okay. That wasn't as good a connection. Let's try.
We are having a little trouble hearing you.
Let's try this again. So, give us a little background on the race itself. It starts. You set sail next week, November 3rd, 5,600 miles. This is the 20th anniversary of the race. And how many different boats are in this competition?
Well, there's 25 class 40s, which is what Hannah and I are sailing on.
Okay.
And then some 60-foot monohull boats, IMOCA 60s. And there are five multi-50s, which are trimarans, and two mod 70s, which is also a trimaran. So I think there's like 44 different boats.
And so in your class, in the 40s, is it a one design? Is everybody sailing the same boat, or can you innovate on your own boat to adjust things the way you want them?
The boat into a box, so it's not strict. One is a bit with a mast, boat, beam, length. It's all got to fit. You look at that, right? The 25 foot. There's some similarities. They're also... So there's a lot of room for innovation.
Okay. Hannah, your connection is not as good as Rob's. So that's not intentional.
It must be an American thing. I think it must be from America. Exactly. So that must help.
That's right, Rob. You're from Long Island. Is that correct?
I am. And I actually have been to Utah. Anna's actually been as well.
Okay.
It's a good spot.
Well, give us a sense of, how long is it going to take to sail this 5,600 miles? And what kind of conditions are you expecting to face?
So it's going to take us between 3 and 4 weeks to get there. It's probably in the neighborhood of 5 to 27 days in total. And I would think that it would be just about every kind of you could think of. We have some, maybe a little bit more wind than we would like to see. Because when we get close to the equator, we're going to have some spots where there's wind at all.
Right.
So it'll be it'll be very interesting, and that's what makes it also exciting. So
okay.
Great. So one of the things that you've been talking a lot about in the approach to the race is a lot of the innovations that you have on the boat that have to do with your environmental impacts. Tell us about some of the ways you're trying to minimize those impacts.
I think I'm right there at the end of that. Can you still hear me?
Yes, we've got you.
We were asking about some of the environmental stuff you have.
We're just on another. We are trying with our sponsor, 11 Hour Racing, which hang on, we got a new phone. Let's try this.
All right. Yeah.
With our sponsor, 11th Hour Racing, we are planning not to use any diesel fuel to charge our batteries on the way across the Atlantic.
Right.
So we're going to use a hydro generator, which basically is it looks kind of like a little bit of an outboard motor. And we put it down in the water behind the boat, and it spins, the propeller spins, and as it spins, it generates electricity. We're also trying to only end up, after 27 days on a boat, with two of us, with only one bag of garbage, which will be... that's a tough one. But we've planned well and we've prepared well, so we're doing that. We're going to grow some microgreens. City Blooms is a company out in California who has figured out a way to for people to grow microgreens on rooftops, and we are going to set an example by showing that you can grow it in the middle of the ocean. So that'll be kind of neat.
Taking local gardening and farming to a whole new level there.
Yeah.
Yeah, trying to prove that, if we can do it in the middle of the ocean on a 40-foot boat, you could certainly do it on a rooftop in Salt Lake City or New York City or, Los Angeles. And we've got some solar panels to help with the hydro generator for our battery charging.
We're making a water maker to make a lot of water, so the whole team for the last 3 months, the campaign is committed to not using plastic bottles, so we'll be drinking seawater that's been turned into fresh water.
Okay.
Tell us about that process.
Yeah, how much water can you generate? Drinking water can you generate per day?
On the temperature of the seawater depends on how efficiently the water maker runs. But if it's running really well, we'll be making something around 10 to 12 liters in an hour. The thing we have to manage versus other teams is because we're not using our engine, the water maker draws quite a lot of power. So we'll need to make sure we make the water when we're going fast, because we only put the hydro generator into the water when we've got good boat speed, so that we generate maximum electricity and cause minimum drag. So we're just going to have to time our water making appropriately.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask about that. That hydro generator, does that create appreciable drag?
Not really. We need to be doing 8 knots of boat speed before we're comfortable putting it in. And really, once we're doing more than 10, it's very, very small amount. And a lot of the boats here do have them, so everybody else will be using them. By not using the engine the first few days of the race when it's cold up here, the engine is our only source of heat, so we'll maybe have to eat a few more calories to try and stay warm. But Rob and I both trialed this. We brought the boat back from Newport, Rhode Island to Southampton, England in June this year. And we trialed out using the hydro generator as our only source of charging the whole way across for the first time, and it worked really, really well.
So one thing I was wanting to ask you about that you mentioned is some of these environmentally friendly practices just make sense on a boat because they're efficient and they can save you weight or energy or fuel. How many of these practices are other boats in the race doing, and how many are unique to your team?
Hannah just mentioned that a bunch of other boats have the hydro generator. And some other boats have some solar panels and things like that. But I think the whole putting all of those things together as a practice, along with our not having too much trash and growing microgreens, for sure, will be the only one. we're going to be the only team doing all of those things. And not running the engine, for sure. So, I mean, to put it all together, certainly no one else is going to be doing all of them. Some of the other might be doing a small amount of some of the things we do, but when you put it all together in the whole overall of the campaign, we will certainly be the only ones doing all of them.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with sailors Rob Windsor and Hannah Jenner. They are the team on 11th Hour Racing. They'll be competing in the 20th annual Transat Jacques Vabre race starting next week. They're leaving from Le Havre, France, and sailing 5,600 miles across both the northern and southern Atlantic, ending up in Itajaí, Brazil. Is that how you pronounce that?
Itajaí.
Oh, you're right. Itajaí, Brazil.
Itajaí. It does be.
Okay.
It's pretty exciting. We're both really excited about it. It's wonderful to be here in France. This is bigger. I know you guys are in Utah, so some of your listeners might not get to get out to a bunch of sailboat race starts. But I've been to quite a few, and this one is the French really know how to put on a good show when it comes to sailing.
I bet they do, and I bet we could probably see that live online.
You could certainly see some photos on our Facebook page. We're on Team 11th Hour Racing is the name of our Facebook page. And the Transat Jacques Vabre has a has a Facebook page as well where there's a bunch of photos and video and things like that.
And we have already linked to those Facebook pages from ours for any listeners that want to link through our page. So I've got a question about race policy, I guess. Has the committee that's putting on this race set policies regarding the environment in place? Are there rules about dumping waste or how much diesel fuel you can use in a sailing race or things like that? And is there an overall trend in the big boat sailing world on the environmental front as well?
Well, it was just brought into effect this year in the international rules of racing that you're not allowed to throw any trash over the side. And that's a recent thing, and it's quite surprising that that's just become a recent thing. So for all of us here, we have to think much harder about what we take with us, because we must keep it all with us and preferably arrive at the end with most of that being recyclable. I know there's an increasing movement. A lot of it's driven by our sponsor, 11th Hour Racing, to try and prevent or promote cleaner regattas and help people out, like not using single-use plastic water bottles, supplying fresh water supplies at race events. We used to use wool and elastic bands to tie some of our sails up to help with hoisting and dropping them. And, of course, that's banned now because of putting trash into the water. So we all have to think a lot more carefully. And I think it's important for sailing regattas and sailing venues around the world to offer opportunities for boats to be able to recycle and to get fresh water to drink and to really promote all these green practices. And for us offshore and ocean racing sailors, it's not hard to get from A to B without using fossil fuel.
Right.
And if you do have to take diesel, think about biodiesel. That's what we're running with.
Oh, fantastic. And speaking of trash, you know, Nell and I have had talked to some scientists, researchers who look at some of the gyres around the world where lots of trash seems to collect. The most famous one is the Pacific gyre, that, which is, you know, apparently several sizes, the size of Texas, if not larger. Do you see evidence of trash like that in the northern or southern Atlantic or along the equator?
We
have to avoid?
We do actually see some trash. Anna and I saw a bunch on the way over here. And one of the things that we're doing our campaign and during this race is we're working with five gyres, and we are going to every single day for 1 hour a day give them an update of what we see and the locations of where we are. Every day. So we're really kind of excited about that because Hannah and I make our living out here on the ocean, and it makes a big difference to us whether or not there's trash in the water. And, I mean, it's I'm trying to think of a good way to say this on the radio, but I'll leave it for another time. But you don't do certain things where you eat. So we eat and make our living on the ocean, and we're happy to help out five gyres and try to make a difference and figure out where there is some stuff that can be cleaned up and looked after.
Great.
Fantastic.
I mean, I was asking, this is an opportunity to collect data, you know, for scientists as you travel.
It certainly is. To put a sort of science ship out in the middle of an ocean requires an awful lot of money, and here we are. I mean, there's 40-something of us. I mean, if we could all be out there doing it, and if the much wider cruising community out there could also be collecting data for scientists, and we could make it easy and show people how easy and how effective it is to collect data, then you'd have this great, fantastic network of cruising and racing sailors able to assist the science world.
Actually, excellent. Are there stops along the way, or is this 5,600 miles straight on?
It's straight. Straight there.
No kidding. Yeah. So you've got to bring enough. I mean, you're generating your own water, but, you know, and growing some greens, but you've got to bring enough food for 30 days and fuel. That's a lot.
We have to bring a lot of food. You know, Rob's a big guy. He eats an awful lot. We don't really have cooking facilities. We can only boil water. So all of our food, really, or the bulk of our food, is freeze-dried. And whereas once upon a time we'd have individually packaged meals, so we'd get through maybe four packets of food a day, and that's all. We have now gone to having big tubs of freeze-dried food. So we have five reusable big tubs, and we've done away with 100 individual packages from our meals that we're going to have on board.
Wow, that's fantastic. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So I was reading your profiles, and it seems like you're a pretty unique team in that one of you is a young woman and the other is an American. Are there many other Americans and women in the race?
Well, you know what? I think we just lost them.
Oh.
I'll tell you what. Let's take a break. And we might get them back for a final few minutes if we had a few more questions. You're listening to This Green Earth, and we'll be right back after these words from our underwriters.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond at Republic Services, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Gray is for garbage. Those four words will help you remember the current waste and recycling program. Your blue or brown bin is for recyclables. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Join KPCW every weekday morning from 6 to 8 a.m. for the latest news in town and around the world. Trusted news anchor Leslie Thatcher delivers local news as well as broadcasts of NPR News, Marketplace, and national stories. Morning Edition with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you by Promontory the Ranch Club, Nexus IT, and Jance Mountain Outfitters.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. We lost our first guests, Rob Windsor and Hannah Jenner. I think they're back. Fingers crossed. Are you guys back?
We're back. Sorry about that.
I'm sure it wasn't your fault.
We're happy to have you back.
Yeah.
It was all Hannah's fault. It's always a woman's fault. It's definitely Hannah's fault. I got to blame somebody. So.
All right. Well, we can just see how you guys will do for 30
how these
days
dynamics
on the,
will
on
do
the ocean.
On the boat.
Well, anyway, we were nearing we were getting down to the end of the conversation anyway. But like you guys are saying, you're going to generate one garbage bag, and you had to hold this trash for 30 days. And
yep.
Okay. And you said that's going to be a real challenge.
Well, we sailed across the Atlantic and we were trying to practice and see. In June we did that, and we were for training. And we tried to use as little trash as possible. And I think we ended up with like 7 bags.
Well, the common thing amongst many is now a racing rule of sailing, but for many of the cruising communities, it's considered acceptable to throw soda cans and cardboard and paper and things that are considered biodegradable over the side. We've been working with a project called the Rosalia Project, whose mission is to clean up the oceans, and they have enlightened us as to just how long it really takes for something like a soda can to dissolve, because the misconception is it goes in a couple of days, which it really doesn't. So for the first time probably ever, Rob and I both tried out sailing back across the Atlantic, throwing absolutely nothing over the side. And we thought that maybe we'd come back with 3 bags of trash, and we came back with 8. And we were pretty horrified that a lot of that would usually go into the sea. Hmm. So we're really hoping to set an example, not just to racing sailors, because racing sailors generally carry less anyway because of weight, but to the cruising community, that it's just not acceptable to throw this trash over the side.
Right.
Okay. Well, it's great to hear about all of the sustainable and environmental practices you guys are doing on the race. We would love to follow you. As we wrap up in the last couple minutes, how can we follow the race, and where can our listeners find out more about you guys?
So the Transat Jock Bob has a website, and on team11thhourracing.com.
they will be able to follow us and find out everything about us, and they'll be able to see the race tracker. And also on Team 11th Hour on Facebook. If everybody can like that, we're actually trying to make it to 1,000 likes before the start. And the last time I checked, we were at like 850. So if we could get a couple extra likes from the middle of the country out there, maybe from you guys, that would be a big help.
Fantastic. Well, we have a surprisingly strong sailing community here in Park City, so yeah. we'll try to get that group on board and give you guys some support. So,
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us.
Rob Windsor, Hannah Jenner, sailing with 11th Hour Racing, the 20th Annual Transat Jacques Vabre race starts next week. You can follow them online. Thanks again, guys, and best of luck. And you know what? Let's circle back and talk to you after the race. And see how things went.
That sounds great. We'd love to do that. We'd love to give you a wrap-up after we're done.
That's a deal. Thanks again, and we'll be in touch. Let's take another quick break for some underwriters, and we'll be back with our next guest. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
I'm John Wells. Join Lynn and I Thursday morning for Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a fun and understandable way. We'll be talking with James Fallon, who's written The Psychopath Inside, a neuroscientist's personal journey into the dark side of the brain. And then Brian Hare, who has written The Genius of Dogs, how dogs are smarter than you think. Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we are proud of our international sophistication.
I love British accents.
Here we go.
No, really, I was in England one time for a couple of days, and they kept them up the entire time I was there.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the quiz that's funny in any language. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Heard on KPCW, Saturday morning at 9, thanks to 350 Main and the Spur Bar and Grill.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board.
Hello.
And in the studio with us for the second half of the show is Kenner Kingston. He is an architect, a partner, and the sustainability director at the local firm of Architectural Nexus. And he's going to talk with us about a new green building rating system. So, Kenner, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
We're happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about your current work and practice and how you got into the sustainability side of architecture.
Oh, I'm known for not being able to tell short stories, so I'll do my best. let's see, current work. I was just mentioning to you and Chris that I'm going to be working on a internet radio, kind of a blog center, media center for University Hospital, which is kind of fun. And it's fun to be in the studio and see how you've solved certain problems. So that's great. That's coming up, small project that I love to do. Also, have just finished a number of post-occupancy evaluations for Salt Lake County Library System for Salt Lake County, where we evaluate in detail a number of aspects of the building in terms of sustainable performance, energy use, occupant comfort, alternative transportation success, recycling success, conduct waste stream audit. It's been a lot of fun. And so with the goal in mind of saving money, Salt Lake County is just a fantastic steward of public funds and trying to always find ways to optimize their operations. And that's a passion of mine.
Well, it's impressive to hear that somebody had the commitment to go back and audit and review this project that's already complete and see if it's actually functioning up to standards.
Absolutely. We actually reviewed three projects, one of which we suggested was our own, so that we had, you know, we really value authenticity, and we want to see how we're doing, not just how our competitors are doing. And so we did learn a lot about how we can improve our own designs, and I think the government agencies learned a lot about how they could better train all their architects, not just our firm, in terms of helping them get what they're looking for. Because sometimes the gap between design intent and reality is larger than we'd like it to be. And so we have to manage that gap by looking at the work we've actually done and evaluating it. With, again, the real goal is making sure that the buildings function as intended and operate as economically as possible.
So, Kenner, do you have some projects in the Park City area that our listeners are familiar with?
I sure do. Architectural Nexus was fortunate to be the architect of record, design architect, on the Park City Medical Center. The project, of course, is a very large team. I had the good fortune of being the head of that team to put it together, and it was a labor of love and a long process to get it done, but certainly worthwhile. And I know whenever I meet people that have been in the project, I first tell them condolences for having to have experienced the hospital, but hopefully it worked out well for you while you were there. And usually people are really pleasant about it, but some people do have some really bad experiences that take them to hospitals. And so it's important that those facilities be appropriate, reduce stress. And the board that we worked with here in Park City is really to be commended, and Intermountain Healthcare for being willing to put together a healthcare facility that is as much a hospitality facility as it is a healthcare facility. And, you know, that's just Park City. It's just appropriate.
I go there for the food.
Yes.
So, I mean, lots of people go there to have lunch or otherwise because it's a great restaurant.
It is.
And that's actually one of the components that goes into, in a sense, a sustainable type of structure or processes, particularly with a hospital.
Yes.
Is having a healthy food or dietary base.
Yeah, a whole view is critical. And food is a big part of sustainability and sustainable operations. As we're looking at sustainable operations for our own office, I think food was one of the biggest struggles we had in terms of making sure that, because we don't have our own kitchen, we can't source sustainable food, so we have to depend on vendors, third-party vendors. And we found that Roots Cafe, it's right near the Mill Creek Community Center, which is also our project. That's a LEED Gold project. The Roots Cafe in Mill Creek is Wendy there is just fantastic in terms of authenticity. She totally opened her books for us, showed us exactly where all of her food products are coming from, and helped us earn the LEED points we're going for existing building certification. Many listeners might not know that the LEED rating system has a flavor for new construction, but also for existing mm-hmm. building, for operations. And so we're aggressively pursuing that rating.
So how long have you been involved in this, you know, in sustainability efforts as they relate to architecture? Has that been a career-long interest of yours, or is that more recent?
You know, it is a career-long interest. It's something that you probably are you get from your parents and becomes part of who you are. And then while you're learning the trade of architecture, you do have to sideline some of the higher level issues for a while you learn the basics. And so I would tell you that my time at the University of Utah really was defined by sustainability. And then the early part of my career was defined by figuring out how to put buildings together. And then once I had that kind of figured out, then I returned to sustainability. And the return to sustainability was offered in large part by the office building that we constructed for ourselves at the mouth of Parley's Canyon, the Architectural Nexus Design Center's LEED Platinum. And we used that opportunity to kind of redefine our organization and for me to set a new direction for myself professionally. And it's been just fantastically rewarding.
Well, you talked about at times the architectural intent doesn't necessarily always map up with the architectural reality. Give us an example of maybe perhaps earlier in your career or so where your intent and your reality had challenges.
Yeah.
In what areas?
I distinctly can think of a building that I was a part of that one of the goals of the aesthetic of the building was to expose the structure. And as we thought of ways to expose the structure, we chose to put glass into ceiling spaces so you could see from the outside, see into ceiling spaces, which is and it worked very well. It's very attractive. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that, you know, I think of it as one of my chief carbon sins. We're letting heat into the ceiling plenum of this building that's radiating into occupied space. And, it's a concern. And but, you know, even as recently as the Mill Creek Community Center that I just told you we've done a post-occupancy evaluation on, the building is stunningly lit. It is absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. And we're struggling to get the daylighting systems to operate properly so that these wonderful lights can turn off during the day because the building is very well daylit. And so there's lots of opportunities for intent and action to come apart. But it requires kind of continuous improvement, a process of being willing to remain engaged and find solutions.
And then there's client intent and client desire versus sustainable activities too that can come at head too, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They may want a you know, a 5 million gallon water feature.
Yes, that's true.
Just as an example, or something that requires a lot of energy or a lot of natural gas for heating or cooling needs. And so you're constantly kind of balancing client intent with sustainability concepts.
Yeah, you know, the architect's role in many ways is to maximize the opportunity for any project based on the values of the client. It's not practical to try to infuse your values into the clients, but hopefully what you do is through the good work you do, you find synergies over time and you start to get better alignments with the folks that are seeking you out so that you don't have those kinds of inherent conflicts. But,
right.
I'm inherently a teacher and I love to find ways to teach, but you're absolutely right. There are limits and you have to be careful about those limits.
Yeah.
So, Kenner, we wanted to talk to you about this new green building rating system, I guess, called the Living Building Challenge that you're involved in. And the first question, I think, is why a new rating system, right? There's, you know, LEED that's very popular, really well known. There are a couple of others floating around out there. Why Living Building Challenge?
Well, I'm going to answer that question, but I'm first going to say a couple of things about the Living Building Challenge. It's administered by the International Living Future Institute, ILFI.org, if you want to look it up. And this group is an incredible group to whom I am a volunteer presenter. I have received Living Future accreditation with the group, which we can get into in a separate conversation what that means. But it's important to note that I'm just a fan of the Living Building Challenge, really. I don't represent the organization and I can't make commitments for the organization, but I really want to do everything I can to help the organization as a volunteer presenter. So the Living Building Challenge, why another rating system? That's a great question. You know, to a large degree, LEED is and has become synonymous with sustainability in the built environment. But if you think about the word sustainability, it is a little bit dangerous in that it strives to kind of meet do less harm, a harm reduction kind of approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not really about doing necessarily about doing the most you can do. It's about doing what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the right place to start around 1996 when LEED took off, and then in our market in the early 2000s when it hit. It was exactly what we needed to kind of pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and get aware and get our attention, get our eye on the ball. The problem is it is kind of a bottom-up strategy that doesn't necessarily look at all of the potential. I know that you work at the Swanner Eco Center, which is a LEED Platinum building and has done more than LEED Platinum. It's a really good example of that. And I think that the Living Building Challenge, the gap that it fills for architects and for owners and for the community is that it strives to do the most you can do. It's kind of looking at the altruistic top end of sustainability rather than kind of the middle ground.
So give us an example of some of these seven pedals that you have to, I guess, the goals you have to meet.
Yeah. So what's interesting about the Living Building Challenge is, unlike LEED, instead of having credit categories, it has pedals and imperatives. There are no credits in the Living Building Challenge. They're all required. They're all prerequisites using the LEED language. And so they're called pedals because the rating system uses the metaphor of the flower mm-hmm. to organize itself, which, you know, can sound a little froofy, but if you think about it, it's really great because a flower is beautiful, it's functional, it's rooted in place, meaning it has a sense of place, which all architecture should, and it is capable of generating its own energy and getting all of its nutrients from within its own ecosystem. So it is, if a building could take on that kind of a, that metaphor, then we're talking about something that's truly regenerative and restorative, not just sustainable. Do you see how sustainable can start to sound like minimizing expectations versus creating a regenerative, restorative building that takes the habitat that surrounds it back to the way it was pre-development? We're talking about some pretty lofty goals, frankly.
So how might – I'm sorry, but so how might the Swanner Eco Center been designed or constructed differently, like using LEED versus – versus the living building challenge.
Well, and also in the need for disclosure, the architecture firm Cooper Roberts CRSA did that design. I know Kathy, and yeah. It's a fantastic design.
Sure,
it's short by only probably some additional solar panel on solar power generation on site. Frankly, you've got the water. In order to be Living Building Challenge certified, you have to be net zero water. You have to be net zero energy, and it's on site net zero energy. It's kind of that responsible owner approach, not renewable energy credits or offsite energy, but right here on site.
Okay, that's what net zero means.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the question to you now would be: do you have water rights on site?
Right, which gets into a whole big discussion. Yeah. But I was just going to ask, how does somebody in the arid West create a building that's net zero water?
Well, if you can get a hold of the water rights, which is a we'd have to have an hour discussion on that.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've got well access to water, and you've got enough acreage, which doesn't have to be a lot, but it can't be just the size of your building footprint to have a drain field to percolate the water back in, then you can do that. Now,
I see.
I was part of a consortium that put together a study on water reuse in Utah a few years back because projects like Swanner Eco Center and Miller Toyota downtown were engaging the issue of water reuse appropriately and getting pushback from the state of Utah to say, hey, this isn't your water. So I wanted to know what is the nature of water reuse regulation in Utah, and it's a giant mess. It's very, very difficult, but there are several state representatives that are interested in the idea and trying to find ways to crack that nut to help it out. But the long and short of it is there are lots of ways that water can be legally reused in buildings today. And in order to qualify for the Living Building Challenge, they understand that you may or may not be able to completely fulfill the requirement of net zero water given the state of regulation in your jurisdiction. But what you're required to do is fight the man. You're required to become an activist. And as long as you put all the connections in the building so that the day the laws change, you can turn the valve and go net zero, you'll be certified. You'll reach the certification level.
Okay.
And so you have to just produce a letter that says, this is how we tried to productively change regulation towards a better result.
That's really incredible to have advocacy almost as a part of this requirement.
It's a big part of it. And, the rating system comes out of the Northwest, and I think that mentality is more prevalent along the coasts, say, than in the Intermountain Corridor. And so we're happy to see it come here and want to work with it.
Wow. Can I just buy credits?
Yeah. Can somebody else do it for me?
Well, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Kenner Kingston. He's an architect and partner at the firm of Architectural Nexus, and we're talking about, among other things, LEED and more importantly, the Living Building Challenge. Are you seeing clients, more and more clients coming to you that do have an environmental consciousness or environmental awareness or a desire to do the right thing on an environmental level?
That answer, I wish I could say a resounding yes.
Yeah.
But what I can tell you is those that have engaged the issue immediately at any level immediately get very engaged once they see the value.
Right.
Because there is a cautious engagement at the private level, and there is an appropriately I wouldn't say aggressive, but an appropriate level of engagement at the government level. You know, the USGBC has been in the news in the past year, kind of in a battle with USA Today, and trying to folks are saying, is it appropriate that all government buildings are mandated to LEED? Well,
right.
It is appropriate because we're talking about stewardship, and
yeah.
Mm-hmm. who better to prescribe stewardship than the largest owner of buildings, the largest developer in probably the hemisphere, the U.S. government. And that's gone down to Salt Lake County has LEED standards. Salt Lake City has LEED standards. State of Utah has LEED standards. And those are all very appropriate. We'd like to see that extended into existing building standards. And that we're working with Salt Lake County on that.
Right.
To say, you know, delegating sustainability to architects and engineers and contractors is a good start. But the existing building stock is always going to be greater than the new building stock. And as we build out and fill up our cities and use up the open space, the most appropriate development is going to be in urbanized areas, already developed areas. And we need to think about the fact that the building reuse is where sustainability is now and needs to be focused. And unfortunately, we don't see enough of our private clients coming to us and saying, give us the greenest thing we can have, or we want the most of sustainability. Our market is a little slower there, but we're getting there. And
right.
There are lots of good examples, and we're excited about all of our clients that are interested. But you have to know that I'm a little bit biased because I enjoy really big complex projects and lots of really small projects that are tied up with complex solutions, and a complicated organization is kind of where my head goes. And
yeah.
So I tend to work on institutional projects by nature. So if I had one of my partners here with me that worked on private sector, they'd probably better answer that question,
right.
Frankly. But I don't see enough in the private sector. I'd like to see a lot more.
Okay.
So tell us about some of the buildings that have received been awarded the Living Building Challenge rating. Is that the right term?
Certification is the right term. You know, to the best of my knowledge, there are only four buildings on the planet that have achieved the certification.
So it's pretty new.
It's 2006, I think, is when it gets, it's been percolating before then, but in 2006, I think it launches. In 2009, they get an update, and it is much newer than LEED, and its market penetration is much less. So, its goals are much more aggressive. So I think it takes time to gestate something like that. There is a building, I believe it's in Seattle, the Birchie Living Building Science Wing. I haven't visited that one. The Hawaii Preparatory Academy Omega Center for Sustainable Living, I believe, was the first. It's in upstate New York. The building that's getting the most buzz right now is the Bullitt Center in Seattle. I don't know if you've heard about the Bullitt Center, but it's a 6 or 7 story building in downtown Seattle, not far off of market rate rents. It is enhanced rents for being in a living building. So this Bullitt Foundation and International Living Future Institute and all the organizations that were part of it, they were really celebrated greatly at the International Living Future Institute's conference this past spring in Seattle, and I got to tour the building, and it's incredible. But you know what's the most interesting is, as incredible as that building is, as incredible as sustainability can be, it's really, when you boil it all down, it's just common sense. It's the stuff we forgot because of the Industrial Revolution and the advent of the modern skyscraper and all glass buildings. And these things are just not sensible. And, you know, sustainability doesn't have to be about patting yourself on the back and about, I'm the greenest. It's just about what would your grandparents have done during the Depression? You know, maybe the recession is going to give us some sensibilities again,
sure.
Bring some of that back so we can just get more real about it. It doesn't have to be more expensive. It doesn't have to be the newest technology. It's usually just the right combination of the right technologies that are already tried and true that make a building great. And I'll tell you, that's what the Bullitt Center is. The Bullitt Center isn't any single amazing technology making the greenest building around. It's just all of them put together all at once.
Kenner Kingston, he's an architect and partner at the firm of Architectural Nexus. Kenner, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, if people want to get in touch with me, of course, there's a number of ways. My email address is kkingston@archnexus.com, just like it sounds. Our website is www.archnexus.com. We'd love to hear from people who are interested in taking sustainability from the realm of new construction and into existing building and operations.
Right.
If you've thought about sustainability as something that was only to be dealt with in new construction, I'd like to change your mind on that.
And I might add, you have an upcoming event here in town to talk about the Living Building Challenge at the Swanner Eco Center. And that's on Tuesday, November 12th at 6 p.m. And really quickly, what can people expect that evening?
That evening, it's a one-hour presentation. Again, I'm a volunteer presenter for the organization, and it's a wonderful presentation that is a complete introduction and overview to the challenge. And it will give everybody a good idea of what's involved. So folks that are interested from an owner's point of view, architects, engineers, you name it, it's valuable for everybody. You just have an interest in sustainability, want to know how you could what are initiatives that might apply to your own home? It's very valid. It is a very high level presentation geared mm-hmm. for architects and engineers, but I think it's important that we have an open dialogue that is relevant for all attendees.
Sure.
So I hope to see a big room full of fans of the Living Future Institute like myself, and
right.
we'll try to learn more together.
All right.
Fantastic.
All right.
Well, Kenner Kingston, thanks for joining us today, and we'll hope to hear from you down the road once the Living Building Challenge is, wildly popular in town.
Right on. Thank you.
Thanks. Let's take another break for some underwriters, and we'll come back with a couple of news items and calendar events. It's The Screen Earth. Stay tuned.
Since 1983, we've been trying to say something clever in support of our favorite radio station. This is Ann from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, complimenting KPCW for making interesting radio under strict regulations. We try to do the same given our short growing season, various microclimates and soils. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond with Republic Services, your recycling and garbage services provider and a proud supporter of KPCW. Recycling pickup in Summit County is now every other week. Remember, recycling materials go in your larger blue or brown bin. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We got a few more minutes. One item in the news I found that was really interesting is that this from the National Climatic Data Center, September 2013 was the globe's fourth warmest September since records began in 1880. And the National Climatic Data Center is part of NOAA. In addition, the year-to-date period of January through September, this 9 months of this year, has been the sixth warmest such period on record. Globally, again, not just in Utah or in the U.S. This is globally. We're headed to this year to be the sixth warmest on record, which then would fit in with all the other warmest years on record,
right,
which also
right.
happened to be
in the last 20 years.
In the last, maybe even less.
Less than that, yeah.
So the warming trends or such continues. And finally, September 2013 was the 343rd consecutive month with global temperatures warmer than the 20th century average.
343rd month. Let's see. Can we do the math on that?
I can do it. I'm done.
How many years is that, Chris?
Almost 30. It's like 27
Perfect.
Years. Roughly 27 years. All right. So that's
all right.
That's that. Let's do a calendar event thing real quick.
Yeah. I wanted to mention a science event coming up at the Swanner Eco Center tonight. It's called The Science Behind the Magic Family Science Night. And there are 10 different science experiments that are kind of, spooky, creepy, crawly, very cool, that our education staff has been working on. And the event goes from 6 to 8 p.m. tonight, and it's $2 per person. And we encourage everybody to come in costume.
Perfect.
So I will see you there if you go.
All right. I bet. Let's do one more. Got to do one more underwriter, and we'll be back to wrap up. It's The Screen Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional, FHA, and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up and thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore,
Rocky Mountain Power,
San Francisco Design,
and of course, Prudential Utah Real Estate.
And you can join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth, where we'll post a bunch of information from this today's show, among other things.
That's right, and we always look forward to your comments and ideas for future shows. So you can also email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Again, thanks to our guests, Kenner Kingston and Rob Windsor and Hannah Jenner, who are going to be sailing across the Atlantic. I'm really looking forward to talking to them when they get back.
When they get back,
sometime
that's right.
In December, hopefully. Thanks again for joining us on This Green Earth. We'll be back next week with another show. Remember, this is KPCW Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.